Why do you say that, Father? You aren't afraid, are you?
No. But I respect some of the superstitions of others. Often they are founded in fact.
Broadcasting live from our Sanctum Sanctorum in Venice, California, this is the Sixth Sense Society. I'm your host, Krista, here with our producer, Michael, and today you're tuning in to Spell It Out, Magic, Reflections, and Shadows, where I take a topic and run with it. So today I'm going to do the second part of my series on Pluto, which I'm sort of loosely calling it the call to Hades. And if you go back and listen to my first one, you will know why. And today I'm going to be focusing mostly on mythology connected to Pluto and his brothers, how Pluto got his kingdom, and a little bit about Pluto as a character. And then, you know, maybe a few little odds and ends, but that's the main theme. And before we get started, Michael does have a few announcements.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to our broadcast. I'm just going to run over our guests coming up real quick. We've got an exciting month this month. Next week, we have Merle Yost, our good friend, family therapist. Not quite sure what the topic will be, but Merle's always highly entertaining, so please tune in for that. And then on the 18th, it is tax day. So we figured we're going to do money spells to help you guys with your taxes with our good friend from Australia, Sandra Inman. She's awesome. And then we're going to end the month with Dolly Safran, who is one of those famous cases of UFO abduction. So she'll be joining us, and it's going to be a heck of a lot of fun. And our good friend, Matt Apsher, will be co-hosting that one with Krista. So tune in for that. That's going to be a very lively discussion. We're really looking forward to that. And then the other announcement is we are going to do our series, a seven-week series of tarot classes. It'll be on Sunday night starting May 21st, and it's $300. It's our method that we've used with Kabbalah, and we've been professional readers now for 26 years, so it's our knowledge that we'll be passing on, and we have a lot of fun with it. And we keep the class small, so we're looking at about 12 people. So get a hold of us or go to Eventbrite, and you can sign up on there. It's going to be by Zoom, so wherever you are, participate. It'll be a lot of fun. So, and then get all the information on our website, sixthsensesociety.com, S-I-X-T-H, all spelled out. And while you're there, buy us a coffee on Ko-Fi. But the main thing you can do is click like and subscribe, and that really helps us a lot. So don't want to take up any more of your time, so I'm going to kick it back to you, Krista. So take it away, Krista.
Great. Thank you, Michael. And Michael might have said this, but it begins on a Sunday, May 21st, 7 p.m., at least at this point. And we will be posting some links to the Eventbrite to make it easier for you. But you can always, you know, email us if you have any questions. So let's get started on today's topic. You know, most of us in school, I don't know why, but I do remember learning some Greek mythology in school. And most of us know very, you know, basic things about Greek mythology. And so what I found, though, is, and I found this when I once studied Chiron. I read three books on Chiron because I was going through my Chiron return. And it's interesting that some of the details, and they will differ because it is basically a mythology. But it's one of those things that's very interesting and complex. And I think I've said this on other shows, is that sometimes even astrologers will cherry pick what they want from the mythology and sort of overly emphasize some part of it. And eventually, you know, it kind of rebounds, you know. And so people start saying, wait a minute, there's some other aspects to this story that are really interesting. And the other thing, besides, there's a couple other things that you can get for yourself from studying the mythology connected to astrology. One is you can see where the mythology is playing out in your chart. And I know Joseph Campbell was really big on the idea of mythology being a way of framing one's life and giving you purpose. But what's also interesting, he probably said this too, it's been a while since I've listened to him, that in mythology, there are solutions to problems, and there are ways to approach whatever the difficulties are that are actually quite practical. And I'm going to talk about that a little when we go through the mythology of part of the mythology of Pluto today. So I found this really great family tree of the Greek mythological, the three generations that we're kind of talking about on this YouTube site called Useful Charts, which also has charts of like monarchies and things. It was really wonderful. So I'm going to post a link to it after the show sometime so you can see it, because it was really great to see it all like diagrammed. And so I went there and I wanted to just get an overview of those three generations. The first being the primordial gods. There were six of them, with the most important one being Gaia. And I'm using the Greek names here. And then after that, the next generation are the Titans, and there are 12 Titans. And then the third generation are the Olympians, which start out as six children, but eventually they managed to make 12 out of it, kind of the way they wanted to, I think, to make it sort of balanced. So we're going to talk just briefly about the lineage to see sort of where Hades comes from. So in the story of Gaia, she gives birth to three gods, one being Uranus. And there's a lot of inbreeding in the mythology. So Uranus basically marries her. And at that time, Uranus ruled all of the world. There was no sort of separate kingdoms. And so there was only Uranus ruling it. And so Gaia and Uranus, they gave birth to these 12 Titans, and some monsters that included the Cyclops and the Hecatoncheires. I think I said that right. They're these monsters with 50 heads, and they're important in the story. So anyway, for whatever reason, Uranus does not like the Hecatoncheires and decides to imprison them in the earth against, of course, Gaia's will. Gaia's the mother, and she loves all of her children equally, and so she becomes very angry. And most people know a little bit of this particular myth, where she makes a sickle and asks one of her Titan children, the 12 children, to use it on Uranus. Now, I don't know if she told him what to do with it, but basically the only one that would do anything was the youngest one, Cronus. And he agreed and castrated his own father. There's also a whole myth around what deities came out of that from that, but we're not going to talk about that. And Cronus was the god of the harvest. And there is another Cronus spelled with a CH that was Old Father Time. So don't get them confused, which is interesting because I think that means there could be two Cronuses in the tarot too, I think. So maybe I'll talk about that another time. So anyway, then Cronus marries Rhea, the goddess of fertility, and they become the next rulers and the next generation of ruling. And then there's a prophecy given, I forget who gives the prophecy, might have been Uranus even, that one of Cronus's children is going to take him out. And so he's really nervous and scared about it. And he decides his solution was to basically eat all of his children as they came into the world. And he thinks he does, all six of them. And but however, Rhea manages to trick him into eating a stone instead of Zeus and Jupiter. So who were these six children? They're the ones that we're going to be spending a little more time with, especially the male. We have, as I said, we have the Jupiter, which is Zeus. We have Poseidon, Neptune. And then we have, of course, Hades, Pluto. And then there's Demeter, Juno, and Hestia. Those are the three females. So those are the six children. So anyway, what happens then is she hides Jupiter, or Zeus, I'll call him, since that's the Greek name. She hides him somewhere and he grows up somewhere else and he becomes a young man. And then he goes, oh, by the way, he was raised by a goat, which is interesting because the goat is connected to Saturn. So anyway, there's all these like little connections that are really cool. So anyway, Zeus ends up serving Cronus as a cupbearer. And of course, Cronus thinks, you know, his son is dead and he has nothing to worry about. And then he gets with this goddess, Mati, who makes this concoction in the cup, and they have that Uranus drink it, and it causes him to throw up the other five children, so they're able to escape from Saturn. Now, one astrologer really looks at that part of mythology in a really fascinating way. I believe it's Aaron Sullivan, it's either that or Liz Green, but where you can look at something connected to Saturn, how Saturn is both mother and father in the sense that, you know, Saturn's pregnant. And there's always this debate about the fourth house and the 10th house, which one is the mother, which one's the father. But the thing that was really interesting to me was what this one astrologer pointed out, that Saturn is the devourer. And you have to be careful not to let Saturn sort of take over everything. And I thought, wow, that is so true. Anytime I've studied Saturn, I feel like it takes me over. Like that's the only thing I look at in the chart. The other thing you can take from this myth, which I think is interesting and you can apply, or this part of the myth you can apply to your own life, is that there's this connection to Zeus, which is Jupiter, and Saturn. And that when there's a connection between Jupiter and Saturn, there could be some sort of release that happens because of that connection. So there can be sort of, so you can kind of look at that in your own chart, or you can look at the transits going on. So that's one way to kind of sort of metaphorically look at, you know, the chart and see how this mythology plays out in your own chart. So anyway, so Zeus is free, and so the other siblings are free. And next comes this 10-year war between the Titans, the older gods, and the Olympians, and led by Zeus, called the Titanomachy. Amici, something like that. I'm not really great with some of these pronunciations, even though I did practice a little. The Cyclopes helped in the war, and I think it was during, I don't know if it was before the war or after, they gave each of the three brothers their gifts that they're famous for: the Thunderbolt for Zeus, Trident for Neptune, and Invisible Helmet for Hades. And of course, the Olympians won, and they took over the kingdom, and they agreed to allow Zeus to rule. Now, this is a good part in terms of, this is how Hades got to rule the underworld. As long as the two other brothers, not the females, I guess they're out of luck, they can have a kingdom too. So we went from one main deity, male, ruling all the universe, to three. And so what they did was draw straws, at least in one version, and Hades drew the short straw. But I don't get the impression that Hades necessarily minded ruling the underworld, because it was seen as equally important. Though there's some ostracizing, it seems like Hades goes through, because he's not on the Mount Olympus like all the other ones are. And that plays into a little bit of sort of the isolation he might feel. But anyway, that's how he got his kingdom, Hades. And the next thing I wanted to talk about was, now at some point I am going to go over the kingdom itself, because Hades deserves a whole episode, probably even more than 30 minutes. It's so fascinating. I have forgotten a lot of the details of it. But let's talk a little bit about who Hades Pluto was. And as I said in the first video, there was no temple to Hades on Earth. The Greeks were very afraid of saying his name. So sometimes he's called Zeus of the underworld, which is fascinating to me. And one of the other points I wanted to make, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about the brothers, is that I think that first of all, the separate kingdoms, they each ruled these separate kingdoms, and that they all sort of play a role with each other. And so astrology to me is, all about relationship and all about contact in terms of how you interpret it. So you'd want to, I thought it'd be really fascinating to see what happens during some pivotal times in history, where Pluto has been given the sort of like, okay, this is why this happened, because of Pluto. But was it Pluto? Was it Pluto in conjunction with his brothers? So the thing I feel strongly is Pluto is not interested in our world. Pluto has his own kingdom, and it's pretty good. And he's not here to create destruction in our world, though I think he, representing the unconscious, representing reincarnation and transformation, he plays a role in that way. But I believe it's his interaction with his brothers, and probably the other ones too, the other Titans, is what's really causing the havoc in our world. And I only had time to, for instance, take a quick look astrologically at this idea through the U.S. chart when the first atom bomb was dropped. And I think first, before I get into that, I sort of am jumping around. I want to talk a little bit more about Pluto, but I'll get back to that in a minute. So anyway, he's described as grim, gloomy, and mournful, and pictured as a dark bearded man carrying a two-pronged harpoon and driving a black chariot pulled by four black horses, which sounds pretty cool, actually. And I think black animals in general are associated with Pluto. The Cyclops gave him the invisible helmet, which was also used by Perseus to slay Medusa. And this is something I found really, I don't know why I found this humorous. He was indifferent, Pluto was indifferent, or Hades, to people's prayers And the main thing about like what he did in Hades was he kept people there, and he was the one to create the punishments in Tartarus. So he designed the specific punishments. He did not want anyone to leave without, you know, certainly his knowledge, or even enter. He's very strict about it. So he's like the jail keeper in a lot of ways. And there are definitely some interesting stories about, you know, that break those rules, one I'm going to talk about. And one of the most famous punishments everybody knows about is Sisyphus. So that's the one he created. And then there's tons of players in Hades that are really interesting that I'm discovering, like minor ones that are, I'd never heard of. But I did want to mention just a few that are famous. The three fates sit beside his throne. And of course, at some point after Persephone is, you know, adjusted to being in the underworld, she sits as his queen beside him, ruling equally. And then perched on the back of the throne is something called the Blinking Owl. And I didn't have time to research that yet. I'd never heard of the Blinking Owl, and of course the Black-Winged Raven, which I think I had known about. So he lives in a part of Hades that is an island that's a little hard to come by, and he has a palace there, and it's engulfed by fire. What else was there? And then I definitely wanted to mention the importance of Hades ruling wealth and ruling all the precious metals in the earth and the gemstones. And basically that's another thing you can look at in terms of your own chart, is where potentially in your natal chart where Pluto is, that can be where your wealth is. Though it can also be a karmic energy because of the concept of reincarnation. It can be all of that. Or perhaps if Pluto is transiting your second house, that could be interesting in terms of money and wealth. And I will go into the astrology a little bit more in depth. I just wanted to mention it so you can begin to get why I want to talk about this topic in relationship to how do I use this practically. So I wanted to go back to that idea. So that's a little bit about Pluto. And we're going to go into his world next time, and also some of the myth of Demeter and Persephone, because that one takes a little longer. And there was one myth, though, that I wanted to bring up, because one of the things that the modern creative people do is they celebrate Pluto as this erotic god and this sensual relationship that's very, you know, very obsessive and transformative. And I just actually ordered a book that's based on it, a fictional novel. But there's a lot of people interested in sort of telling the story in a different way. And there is some truth in that, in terms of the idea that Zeus had like lots and lots of lovers. He made lots of, like, and some of them he raped people too. And so, you know, Zeus wasn't always great, even though, you know, generally seen as a benevolent time when he ruled. And whereas really, as far as I know, there is only one main partner for Pluto. So it seems like on some level, it's more of a love story and not your typical love story. And I love that, you know, that Persephone is given a chance to become powerful, even though it isn't in the upper world, it's in the lower world. And we'll talk about that later. So I think that there is this element of Pluto in your chart, which can define depending on where it is. Like if it's in your fifth house, it definitely could be that kind of archetypal mythological search for the soulmate in ways and places you wouldn't normally. And definitely you're not going to be drawn to the typical person, because Pluto was, you know, seen as grim and gloomy and mournful. But on the other hand, there are things about him that are very compassionate. And so one of the stories that is a love story is the one connected to Orpheus and Euripides. And so the myth of Orpheus is basically he was, you know, he found his true love, Eurydice, I know I'm saying that wrong, and she dies like really early, a snake bites her and she dies and goes to the underworld. And he's devastated. And Orpheus, of course, played the lyre and made poetry. And so he decides to go on his own to Hades, into the underworld, which is basically no, you don't do that. And he manages through music to seduce everybody, the ferryman, the three-headed dog. And then eventually he gets an audience in front of the queen and king of Hades. And he sings a song of his love to Eurydice. That's what it is, Eurydice. And they're so touched that even Hades is crying, and he agrees to release her for a little longer into the world again, as long as when he's leaving, Orpheus is leaving, he doesn't look back to see if she's there. And so that was a big, big concession. So I found that fascinating. And then unfortunately, Orpheus, who had been so vulnerable and so trusting, just as he's about to get out of Hades, he feels like he has to look back and see her. And because he doesn't hear her when he's leaving, and he's worried, and is she really there? And of course she is, and then is immediately swept back into the underworld. And eventually they get to be together, and Orpheus is killed in kind of a horrible way. But at the same time, they eventually get to be together in Hades. But I thought about that idea. What was the lesson there? And, you know, one person said it was about patience. I think it's about trust and trusting that the deal's going to go through, because it seems to me that there's a lot of deities like the Fates. There are three judges that weigh out justice in the underworld. And that idea that you know, if I make this deal with you, I'm honorable and you can trust me, because especially when, you know, Hades did not make deals normally. It wasn't his thing. He said, you know, you're not supposed to be here, and I'm not going to let someone go who is supposed to be here. So I thought that was an interesting look at how, you know, the king and queen of the underworld, they're not heartless, they're compassionate. And so I've really kind of enjoyed thinking about that in many ways. So the other thing, like I said, I wanted to briefly show that when some of the events like that are attributed to Pluto during the Pluto's discovery, like wars, and in this case, the atom bomb, was the first one was dropped. It was, let me find my chart here so I get the date right, August 6, 1945. And my theory is that there is a lot more going on during that time whenever, I'm trying to find my little cheat sheet on, here it is. There's more going on normally with Pluto, with the brothers, and Saturn. And I certainly only one chart is not enough to sort of prove that. But when I looked at that day, and I didn't do the exact time, there were some interesting things. For instance, Pluto itself, transiting Pluto, is conjunct the natal north node with a 3-degree orb in the 8th house in the U.S. chart in the sign of Leo. So I thought that was amazing. Transiting Jupiter is conjunct the U.S. Neptune in Virgo in the 9th house. So you see Jupiter and Neptune, the two brothers, the 9th house being the house of voyages and higher learning, and it's Jupiter's house. At the same time, transiting Uranus was within 4 degrees of the descendant in Gemini in the U.S. chart. Transiting Saturn was really had been going over a lot of the U.S. Cancerian planets and was at 18 degrees Cancer, which is approaching the Mercury of 24 degrees of Cancer in the 8th house. And then you had transiting Mars conjunct natal Uranus with the 1-degree orb in the 6th house. And finally, transiting Neptune, 10 degrees approaching the natal Saturn in Libra in the 10th house. There was so much going on between these characters that all have a relationship together. And I thought, wow, that is incredible. And I think that, so again, the point mainly being is that Hades does not have power here in this world on his own. And I don't think he cares to have it. I think it's his brothers that are doing it, because remember, it was Zeus/Jupiter who gave Pandora's box, which had all the evils in it that were released. And luckily there was hope. So that had nothing to do with Hades. And so I think that that there's a misunderstanding. And this is one of my goals in the next 20 years, I think, is to try and see, you know, what really is Pluto about? And what is our understanding of it, particularly if it does represent the subconscious, then maybe what's happening is really our own undoings because of our own things caught in the subconscious. And for instance, when Carl Jung was his patients before World War II, and even himself, they started having these dreams that in hindsight, he said he thought they could see the war coming. And that in the dream world, i.e. Pluto's world, you can find indications of what's going on collectively. In fact, that happened before 9/11. Many people afterwards told me they had these dreams that some of them were actually literally airplanes crashing into buildings. They didn't know what to make of it. And so that collective energy is what is indicating what we're thinking of. And that, again, you know, to me, Hades just basically says, hey, you know, I'm going to give justice where it's due. I'm going to give punishments to people that have murdered and done horrible things, because as you'll find out, there's some good people in Hades, you know, the Elysian Fields and heroes and things like that. So I think it's really pretty interesting how we want to project onto Hades slash Pluto in ways that I don't think are really correct. And then there's also part of the mythology. Well, maybe I'll wait and tell you this. There's an interesting thing with Mercury and between Demeter and Pluto that I'll talk about when we talk about the myth of Persephone and Demeter and all of that. So the goal here is to take a look and at your own chart, even if it's not like Pluto, maybe it's Saturn, or maybe you have some Jupiterian thing. And just to give you a crazy example from my own chart. Now, I knew that I told you I had Pluto in my seventh house, opposing Ceres in my first house. But I didn't know until a couple years ago, I have Persephone at the highest point, the midpoint of my chart. And it's pretty much square, both those two planets. And then I decided to take a quick look at what was going on with the transiting Persephone for this show, which I had no idea where Persephone is. And by the way, I believe it's asteroid 399. You just add it in to, if you want to find where Persephone is, you can add the asteroids. It's pretty cool. But fascinating, in my own chart, Persephone is transiting and about to conjoin my Pluto. I mean, it's insane. It's like within 2 degrees, and I'm getting more and more interested in a very, like, I think in a kind of loving way to Pluto. And I've always been a little afraid of that part of my chart, to tell you the truth, even though I understand that Pluto can be the place we evolve the most. And that it's, as I said, I feel like it offers you wealth. In my case, I feel like being in the seventh house, it's given me a life where I get to understand relationships through my job as a tarot card reader, not just my own, but other people's is karmically that. And I do feel like sitting with people from different walks of life and hearing their secrets and reading for them over the years, I have been honored to really learn about all kinds of relationships, not necessarily traditional ones even. So I will say, wherever Pluto is in your chart, I think there is wealth for you, whether it's material wealth, though I do make a living doing this, but it's some sort of hidden treasure and wealth, which I've always felt was connected to Pluto, and that you can basically, once you know that, you say, okay, I'm going to really, you know, kind of hone in on that overall. So I think that this is going to be a very positive adventure for me, and I hope it is for you as well. So definitely take a look at your own chart when it comes to some of these characters, even like where is Saturn in relationship to Pluto? I think that would be a really fascinating thing for yourself. And next time, I think I'm going to dive into the world of Pluto more and continue the mythological understanding first, so that we can get a really good sense of just what is this world like. Thank you for listening, and tune in next time as we continue to explore the esoteric and the obscure together. I hope you have a wonderful week.